Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, I would like to introduce your host for today's conference, Elizabeth Martinez. You may begin.
Thanks very much, Jeff, and welcome, everybody. Thank you once again for coming to the phones to learn more about the next steps in the cardiovascular surgical translational study. We have a lot of content to get through, so we'll get started. The first slide set that we'll begin with is titled SSI Prevention. So we'll go ahead and get started with that. And the goals this afternoon are to review the evidence that's behind the evidence-based practices for SSI reduction, and then we'll move into how we're going to improve care. So we see on slide three, and from the data that dates back to the early 90s, which really launched the Institute of Medicine report, that if you look at those complications that occur in the hospital, a significant number of those are surgical in nature or occur in the surgical population, and you can see wound infections is the second most common that was identified at that time. And in cardiac surgery, there are 300,000 CABGs alone that are occurring in the U.S. annually. And while these rates range and the risks can be as low as less than 1% for a certain patient population in the lowest risk category, the average is 3.51%, which translates into a huge number, over 10,000 annually. And you can see in this slide the breakdown of where those are occurring, 25% being mediastinitis. And, of course, these are associated with increased mortality, length of stay, and a tremendous increased cost. In addition, we know that in cardiac surgery, CABG wound infections are one of those areas that are targeted for non-payment for the complication and the cost associated with that. Historically, we have looked at risk factors that have been intrinsic to the patient, and slide five represents these. This is from a recent study from 2005 that looked at risk factors. Now, these did not include the SCIP measures or the measures that we will be moving into, those evidence-based practices that have been shown to reduce infections. And here we see what are associated with infection. But many of these are not modifiable, or at least not easily so. Perhaps length of procedure, perfusion time, could be modified in some arenas, although I'm sure some of you have very short pump runs. The next slide, in addition, shows more of the traditional risk factors, again, not modifiable. When a patient comes into us, into our care in the morning, there's not much we can do about their age, their nutritional status, or their smoking status. So next we move into these evidence-based practices, and all of you are participating in the Surgical Care Improvement Project, in addition to the Performance Quality Reporting Initiative. Some of you might be practicing that as well. And so these key measures are appropriate hair removal, appropriate prophylactic antibiotic use, and we see here selection, timing, and discontinuation, which you're all familiar with. But in addition, redosing is back on the agenda and back on the list of potential measures for SCIP, which will be added to that hopefully soon because we all feel that that is important. Perioperative normothermia, and that would include non-pump patients, and certainly perioperative normoglycemia for our cardiac surgical patients. So in the next few slides, I'm going to go through some of the principles of antibiotic management. And these are from the CDC. And so one of the principles around how these practices should be implemented and why they are in place, certainly there is literature with them, but the basic principles of antibiotic management are outlined here. So one is the procedure should carry a significant risk of infection and or cause significant bacterial contamination. And cardiac surgery, as you will see on the next line, as reflected by the relative benefit of a surgical prophylactic agent, is one of those areas. Certainly some procedures really don't need these prophylactic antibiotics because the risk is so low. But you can see on slide 9 that it's estimated that if you give antibiotics, the right antibiotic at the right time, to anywhere from 2 to 3 patients, which is the column, the number needed to treat, you will prevent one surgical site infection. So a tremendous benefit because of their higher risk category and you can see this compared to other surgical procedure types. And of course, the antibiotic selected needs to be active against the organisms of interest. The goal is to target skin flora, especially in cardiac surgical patients, since it's a clean operation. We're not going to cover every bug. The next slide shows data from looking at surgical site infections up through 96 of some of the ranges of the organisms that we see. And so you can see those in the top two are Staph aureus and Staph coag-negative, which many of us see, although I'm sure some of you are also seeing the gram-negatives. Best agents for those include cefazolin or ANCEF, which gives us excellent gram-positive coverage and gram-negative coverage for these frequently occurring organisms. This antibiotic, as we see on slide 12, needs to reach a minimum concentration, and the need is to occur prior to incision. And we can see on slide 13 why that makes a difference or how that has been shown to make a difference. So those patients who receive the antibiotics within 60 minutes prior to incision were given a risk of 1 for surgical site infection. If you were given it after incision, your risk increased 2.5-fold. Certainly, if you only receive them post-op, up to 6 times the risk. But importantly is that if you gave it too early, that risk is almost equal to that post-op risk. Actually, it's even higher. So if you see on the far left of this figure, it's 6.7 times higher risk, relative risk, compared to receiving it at the right time. Additional data from cardiac surgical patients are that we need to make certain that these serum levels remain sufficient throughout the procedure. So the time at risk is really when that the skin is open or the wound is open, and for some time after that, while some of the cellular recovery or bridges are being made. So you can see here that if in those patients who did not have an adequate serum level of antibiotics at wound closure, 27% of those patients had postoperative infection. If you had an adequate serum level at wound closure, only 1% of those. So you can see a tremendous benefit from maintaining these levels adequately. The next slide shows in a figure form what the MIC might look like for cefazolin and the time frame. So you can see that getting close to the 4-hour mark, you're at risk, and that might depend on the dose that's given and the volume of distribution of the patient, that your minimum inhibitory concentration might be getting below the level that you require. So redosing is extremely important. Another concept that is extremely important is that we really need to limit the length of time our surgical patients get prophylactic antibiotics, right? And prophylaxis is, again, against that risk of contamination of skin flora into the wound. Cardiac surgery for the Surgical Care Improvement Project, we can give antibiotics up to 8 hours postoperatively, right? All other surgical procedures have a limit of 24 hours. Cardiac surgery was sort of awarded, as I looked at it, this 48-hour mark. And on slide 17, we see some data about what those risks are should we continue those antibiotics longer than 48 hours, right? There are no data to support that antibiotics should be continued till chest tubes are removed, for example, or Foley's or central lines. It's really the time from that risk of the surgical time point, 48 hours post-op. So slide 17 shows that in a prospective surveillance study, observational study of over 2,000 patients, that those who received antibiotics for greater than 48 hours were at higher risk of having a cephalosporin, most frequently commonly used agent of ANCEF, resistant Enterobacteriaceae and Viardi. Okay, so that the risk was 50% higher if you had antibiotics continued for a longer period of time. Again, chest tubes remain in place, Foley's remain in place, a central line, which are some of the frequent reasons why they might be continued beyond the 48 hours. The next slide talks about that Just because we have broader spectrum agents doesn't mean they're better. And the reason for that is they can be resistant if the patient were to develop an infection. And so that we don't think the disease, we want to really reserve these for treating patients with an infection. Slide 19 highlights that just because our hospitals might be restricting the use of vancomycin doesn't mean that it's actually a better agent for skin flora. So vancomycin really only covers the gram-positive. We know that we have some gram-negative, that our patients are at risk of gram-negative when we see them. So that you really want to only use that when you need to. And at Hopkins, we adopted a pretty aggressive protocol for making certain that the patient truly had hives or evidence of a true allergic reaction from a penicillin before we would give or avoid giving cefazolin or Anzac. When you review the thoracic surgeon's guidelines, which if Dr. Engelman was on the phone, he was certainly a part of that group that put together these guidelines. We appreciate those. They recommend that if vancomycin is used, so in these panallergic patients, that you really consider an aminoglycoside for one preoperative dose. You might consider it for one post-op, but really the goal is at the time of incision to prevent that risk of contamination of flora. Now, I would say this probably frequently isn't very done. It would be interesting when we have our questions and answers at the end of this to see how many folks do add gentamicin. We did not do this at Hopkins, and we currently do not do this at Mass General. I know at Hopkins it had been a discussion perhaps for the higher risk patients. And then we move into hyperglycemia. And this is an area where continued data to support that glycemic control in cardiac surgical patients is associated with improved outcomes, and that those who have diabetes much greater improvement in outcomes, perhaps. We still have a lot to learn from this, but the current guidelines from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons and through the Surgical Care Improvement Project are that patients have a post-op glucose of below 200 on post-operative days 1 and 2, and many are moving to a range of approximately 140 milligrams per deciliter to 180 throughout that time frame. One of the key aspects of glucose control and that we're learning is probably variations. So the swings of the really lows and the really highs are what is to be avoided. So as protocols are developed and implemented, that this is something that's important to consider. And you can see here that it's about a 16% or six-fold decrease in risk for glucoses that are less than 220 in this study in 1998. And then many are familiar with the Frenari data from out in the North Pacific Northwest, where the risk of the diabetics really sort of crossed that of the non-diabetics in their risk for post-operative mortality. Okay. So those were the review of the surgical care improvement measures, and those are what most of us are familiar with. And we wanted to give you the background and the data for that, so when you go back with teams and if there are deviations from the performance that we've outlined, these are some data you can share with other members supporting the impact of those considerations. So now we're going to move into some additional considerations and things and components of care that we are advocating for this project. These are not what are going to be collected on a regular basis. We will be receiving data from you on the skip measures, and we will discuss at the end of the call when we are going to consider beginning collecting the surgical site infection data. But these we will be looking at in audit. So the subsequent three topics that I'm going to hit upon will be included in audits. So the first is the results of a meta-analysis looking at the impact of chlorhexidine surgical skin scrub compared to iodine. And so you can see in the black diamond on the bottom, which is the summary of all of the data or the combined scores, that chlorhexidine is favored, such that it reduces the risk of surgical site infection. There are no head-to-head studies of the DuraPrep and chlorhexidine, but a key step that should occur at each site is to move away from iodine if that is the agent that is continuing to use, because there are data that are shown here in addition to what we have learned from the prevention of CLABSI, namely the use of chlorhexidine for skin prep for central line placement, but there really is a growing body of literature in that is supporting the chlorhexidine. The other really added benefit of chlorhexidine that the DuraPrep does not have to the same degree is that that antimicrobial activity really lasts beyond, you know, the 24-hour period, and in some cases, repeated up to 48 hours. So that the goal is to use this as a prep and not to have it washed off post-operatively. And, of course, a key component of this, which we will talk about in the coaching calls and want to mention here, is that with surgical skin prep, the key is that it needs to be done appropriately and frequently. What we saw in the first phase of the focus was that there would frequently be cross-contamination or various providers doing the surgical skin prep, and they wouldn't wait long to use the drapes because you want this to dry, and that is at least a 60-second drying period. And Kathleen, I'm sure, will correct me on that when she does when we give her a chance after this. Okay, so the other area that perhaps many of you are using is selective nasal decolonization, and this is on slide 24. The recommendations from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons perioperative management are to use mupirocin on all patients. What we would advocate is the selective use if that's possible. There are risks of developing resistant organisms if mupirocin is used in all comers, and that is more shown in those that are chronically treated with hemodialysis use patients. But it is important to identify that who are nasal carriers of Staph aureus, and actually any Staph, and to use mupirocin. And this is a recent study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine that looked at surgical site infections, and a subset of the patients were perioperative. And you can see that those who were in the mupirocin and chlorhexidine-treated group, only 4 or less than 1% of those patients had a surgical site infection, a deep wound, compared to over 4% in the non-treated group or the placebo. One of the important considerations in this study is that they used a combination of mupirocin decolonization in 5 days plus daily body fat with chlorhexidine. So this is in the perioperative period that they would get daily baths with chlorhexidine. And if they had an extended length of stay in the hospital, that this program would be repeated every 3 weeks. So that every 3 weeks, if you were still in the hospital, you would receive 5 days of mupirocin and body scrubbing. And as our local hospital infection prevention at Hopkins, this is what they are recommending. If you're going to use the mupirocin, what they have implemented in a selective fashion is to use the combination of the two. So this slide summarizes that and that study protocol. Again, the STS recommendations are that to use the mupirocin would be, you know, much more ideal to be able to do selective decolonization. We understand that not all centers have a rapid PCR assessment to be able to get this information in real time. The final additional area to touch upon is the preoperative chlorhexidine dabs. And there are mixed data in the disease, little data that included just cardiac surgical patients. But this is something to consider as part of a comprehensive program, especially if you're having a problem with surgical site infection, and especially in that patient population who is in the hospital pre-op, which is an increased risk factor for both the colonization and colonization-resistant organisms, i.e. nasal carriers, for staff. So those are things to consider and to add on to programs as we move forward. At 28 gives a summary of, again, that number needed to treat that you can share with other providers of what the impact might be at each of these individual steps. We don't have this for all of the interventions, but certainly the ones that we do, I have included here. So, in summary for these recommendations, first-line antibiotic is cefazolin, and I have 2 grams here. While when you look at the antibiotic literature or the antibiotic pharmacokinetics. It's frequently above a weight of 75 that you would go from the 1 gram to 2 gram intervention. We had implemented at Hopkins giving every surgical patient 2 grams because, well, the majority of our patients were over 75 kilos. But this also is in alignment with the FCS recommendations. They really recommend the 2 grams for anybody who's over 60 kilograms. And I think that the frequency in which our population is less than 60 kilograms is so low that we advocated for the 2 grams for all patients. We need to begin to really focus on redosing of our short-acting cephalosporin. Cephalosporin really needs to be redosed within 4 hours, and we would encourage folks to consider 2 to 3 hours. At Hopkins, we had implemented the 2-hour mark for cardiac surgery, and I know that there are many, many pediatric cardiac surgical centers who have implemented a less than 3-hour mark and may have reported some of their data, one of those being Cincinnati Children, but I haven't seen as much in that adult population. We need to make certain that we are stewards of antibiotic management and that we discontinue our antibiotics prior to the 48-hour mark. When and if we need to remove hair, that we remove the least amount possible and that you use a clipper and not a razor. We want to focus on maintaining glucose in the 140 to 180 range, avoiding those highs and lows, and avoiding hyperglycemia. Encourage the use of clohexidine for skin prep and selective colonization with mupirocin, and that's nasal decolonization. So now we're going to move into really how are we going to improve our practices and how are we going to make certain that every patient gets what they deserve, these evidence-based practices. We'll move on to slide 31, and this is the translating evidence into practice, which you've seen on multiple occasions. This is the TRIP model. So remember that we have the CUSP program, which is the Unity Safety Program, where we're working through identifying local defects using the safety assessment tool, the staff safety assessment tool, but we're also working on reducing infections, so implementing the checklist for CLABSI, maintaining lines appropriately, and now when we move into surgical site infections, implementing these best practices. This next slide, 32, shows a composite of your hospital's performance on the skin measures. These are reported on the Hospital Compare website that you can all access. I last accessed these in March of this year, and they don't separate out cardiac surgery. So this is for all of the patients that they report on. But it does give you an idea of your hospital's performance. And so many are above the 96% mark for antibiotic at the right time and the right selection, a little lower in the 94% range for discontinuation, so it'll be interesting to see how each of the cardiac surgical divisions are performing. The hair removal we're doing pretty well on nationally, but you can see here we have room to improve on the glucose control as well as the discontinuation of antibiotics. So you'll know in more detail that your cardiac surgical specific skip measures. But again, this is an overall of your hospital performance and some insight in perhaps some of your system-wide practices. So how are we going to really ensure patients reliably receive these evidence-based practices? Well, this is the model that we use where you really need to engage the frontline providers, educate everybody, execute, make certain that this happens, and, of course, evaluate how we're doing. The next slide may get into some tips and experiences that we have had to improve this. So the first piece, which is the engagement, is making the problem real. So this is making certain that everybody in the cardiovascular groups, OR, ICU, and floor, really know what your local infection rates are. You want to post these. You want to post how you're doing with your performance, right, because both looking at the process measures and the outcomes for our patients. Certainly, if you bring groups together to learn more about surgical site infection prevention, and there might be a patient who has a story to tell, invite them to tell their story and what the impact of that infection was on their lives. We had a patient share their story. That patient actually happened to work in our sterile processing in the operating room and didn't have a cardiac surgical procedure, had a much more what we might as cardiovascular care providers consider a less invasive or more minor procedure, and how she was out of work and really worried about whether she was going to be able to make her next house payment. I mean, it's a very powerful story of what the impact of this is on patients. The other is really publicly committing that harm is untested, that our goal is zero. Our goal is prevention, and that we as an institution and a division of cardiovascular care are really committing to this zero. You all have champions in your cusp teams, and you really need these in the OR, the ICU, and the floor, because there are all aspects of the care that are impacted. Antibiotic discontinuation is likely occurring on the floor for high percentage of the patients, as is that prolonged glycemic control. And should you then be continuing the bupivacaine or chlorhexidine bands in those patients, that would continue in that arena. Furthermore, there's maintenance of wounds. We know that that we need to keep these areas clean, that you know, we don't know the exact extent of that impact on increasing the risk of infection, but certainly there can be wound breakdown and we need to prevent that. We need to educate everybody who touches the patient and the process, right? So the process is touch pharmacy, how we receive our antibiotics, how we're double-checking that antibiotics are discontinued. If you have endocrinologists involved in developing your protocols, I really want to educate all of these practitioners because everybody can have an impact. You want to educate them on the practices themselves, these evidence-based practices, but also how you're going to improve it and what systems-based factors you can address to improve performance. This can be done, as you all know and are experiencing, in multiple arenas, and you know, we definitely advocate in a continuous fashion using posters and highlighting surgical site infections at M&M venues or morbidity and mortality venues to really investigate each of these. So similar to what you will be doing and what you are doing with the CLABSI infection is that you will use the investigative defect tool to identify systems-based failures that you can address to improve the delivery of these best practices. Here we just have an example of one of the posters that we had developed and used, posted in all of the ORs and the perioperative setting alongside tracking of our data. 47 just has for reference the actual measures, their numerators and denominators as a reference for you as part of your education. So then we move into the execute piece. And certainly a key piece to all of what we're working on, and that's why we do the translating evidence into practice simultaneous with the CUS program, is that all of this is linked to our local culture and our tolerance or intolerance of allowing infections to occur or harm to occur in our perioperative care of cardiac surgical patients. So this is really we support, and the goal is, as a cardiac unit, zero. So the key steps to really enabling us to do this are standardizing, right? So it's not when you get into an operating room and deciding at that moment in time what antibiotic this patient should receive. It's we know in advance what this patient needs to receive because of the surgical procedure that's going to be taking place and because the best agent for skin flora. Another way to standardize and add redundancy into the system or reduce complexity is that you add these steps into your pre-op huddle, your timeout, and then your debriefing. You know, how did we perform? The second and the third reminder to completed and infused prior to incision. The vancomycin is always a challenge to get that in for those patients who have a true penicillin allergy, and you really need to look at how you're going to standardize dosing of that locally. That some of those challenges are local, but we can learn from teams of how they have adopted practices to improve the dosing of vancomycin, making certain that it is infused prior to incision. One of the things we did for antibiotic redosing at Hopkins was we posted the time of the next dose on the report so that everybody could see it was discussed during the briefing, not just, oh, yes, the patient received antibiotics, but the next dose is expected at time, you know, A, B, and C, and that the interaction took place or was to take place between the anesthesiologist and the circulating nurse, that when it was administered, it was an X was placed through that whiteboard. Another thing that we were fortunate to have in place, and I actually have it in place at MGH as well, is a reminder through our electronic data system, our MetaVision that we use, reminding you that it's been almost 4 hours and your antibiotic is due. These plans and how you will execute this effectively, ideas and troubleshooting, identifying these systems-based failures, will take place during your regular custom meetings where ideas will be generated, failures will be surfaced, and you will implement next steps. And these are great things to talk about with your CUS champion, your senior executive. Let's say, for example, you can't get the antibiotic at the right time for the patient who has a penicillin allergy. We need to figure out a system to make certain that that patient gets it. That senior executive can help you troubleshoot some of those things. Then, of course, we have the evaluate piece. We will be tracking the compliance with the skip measures. Again, this is part of what you all are participating in currently, so we will have those data entered. The plan to roll out the data entry for surgical site infection, as I believe we discussed on the call last week, will not begin the start of next month. We will work with the teams and get everybody up to speed with the CLABSI data before we embark upon this, but we're anxious to get started because I know that we are all anxious to see how we can improve and reduce our infections. Again, each infection should be investigated in a formal fashion using the learning from defect tool, walking through the process of what evidence-based practices didn't the patient receive, were there other systems-based factors for this patient, and, of course, during these discussions, patient-specific risk factors come up and can generate, you know, thoughts on how perhaps certain subsets of patients might need to be managed in your unique area. We encourage the posting of the surgical site infections that have occurred, posting them centrally in units, floors, and in the operating rooms so that all providers and if your leadership, you know, agrees, that all patients can see that you're focusing on this, that this is a good thing. We're making certain that we're doing the right thing. In addition to the skip measures and investigating your infections, we will be doing audits, which I'm not going to go back into right now. These were presented at an earlier call and will be revisited on an ongoing basis of what will be audited for surgical site infection prevention. This next slide is an example of some of the posters that you might use, where you're tracking both the time that it's been since the last infection, the surgical site infection, and you can show how well your performance is with the process measures. And here we had it that process compliance this week was, you know, X percent, looking at the composite or the bundle of all of these measures, right? We want every patient to get all of these metrics time. I just want to make some acknowledgments from the incredible infection prevention team at Hopkins that I had worked with while there on clinical site infections, and then some others, Joyce War with the SCA Foundation, and Justin Henneman from MGH who worked with me on that there. And with that, we will hold questions. Kathleen Speck will move into the next phase of discussing the metrics that we will be looking at for surgical site infections, and then we'll have questions at the end. Thanks.
Hi, this is Kathleen. What we're really going to be talking about here is how SSIs are determined for CABG and what they're, how they're evaluated. So, if you look at the objectives, we're going to look at the types of SSIs that can be involved with CABG and the criteria for determination for an SSI and the reporting of SSIs to our study, the STS study. So what we're really looking here at the NHSN-oriented data. So there are three types of SSIs. There's superficial, deep incisional, and organ-spaced. And first we have to look at what NHSN defines an operative procedure as. And this, in some cases, rules out some CABGs. So if you look at it, it says it takes place during a single trip to the OR. and the surgeon makes at least one incision through the skin, and the incision has to be closed before the patient leaves the OR. And if it's superficial, it has to occur within 30 days, involves only the skin and subcutaneous tissue, and it has to have at least one of the following huge list of criteria. The last one of those being the diagnosis of the superficial infection by the surgeon or the attending. So essentially in this last set of criteria, we're looking at the signs and symptoms of an infection. So there are two types of superficial infections. There's a superficial incisional primary, which is from the primary incision, the chest incision, and then there's a superficial incisional secondary, which is from the donor site. On page 8, there's the things that could be viewed as an infection but are not reportable to NHSN, which is stitch, abscesses, and cellulitis. So for deep incisional, there are, again, three criteria. The first one, again, is that there's 30 days of operative procedure. If there's an implant, there's a one-year window. The infection has to involve the deep soft tissue layers, and the patient has to have, of course, signs and symptoms of an infection from the deep incisional area. And these are other parts of those infections, an abscess, and the diagnosis of a deep incisional SSI. There's two types again. There's the primary and secondary. And for organ space, there are, again, three criteria. It's 30 days after procedure if there's no implant, and 1 year if there is. The infection involves any part of the body, excluding the skin, incision, fascia, or muscle layers that is opened or manipulated during the operative procedure, and the patient has signs and symptoms of infection or the diagnosis of an infection by the surgeon or attending. So for CSTS, the reporting site will be asking you for these numbers. We'll want the number of superficial infections for the period, the number of deep incisional infections for the period, the number of organ space infections for the period, and the number of CABGs during the time period. The last would be the denominator. And to go over the specifics of all of that, Dr. Maragakis will be leading a call for the IPs tomorrow at 2, our time, and we're looking forward to you being there. I didn't go on these slides and talk about it, but since Dr. Martinez brought it up, the chlorhexidine issue, there are a couple of different things that can happen with chlorhexidine. And one of the things that we're trying to advocate is that it's used correctly in the surgical arena, which is that you rub briskly back and forth across where the incisional site. And it's really important to do that. Do it briskly. Don't go in circles. Just go back and forth. And you let it dry before you do anything else to it. If you don't wave things at it, you don't blow on it, so I know you know that. That's really important. We're not talking about it, but for catheter insertion, it's the same thing. For central line insertion, you rub briskly back and forth. The procedure for using chlorhexidine doesn't change for central lines until you're doing maintenance, and then how you apply it changes. But for surgery, you use the brisk back and forth method, and then you let it air dry. I'm open for questions.
Thanks, Kathleen. Thanks for addressing that. And the other component of that, that, you know, to consider and what we've seen has been beneficial is in that correct and or appropriate usage is considering using a set of individuals who are trained in the use and doing skin prep and do it consistently so that you really standardize that across the board. It's not just whoever is available in the operating room, oh, here wait, the medical student isn't doing something, so let's have them prep, right? Because this is an extremely important component to reducing surgical site infections. So with that, Jeff, I think we're both ready for questions, and we can open up the line to questions.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. To withdraw your question, please press star 2. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. The first question is from Richard Engelman. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. Elizabeth, I thought that was exceptionally well done and covered the bulk of the information that we had tried to dispense in our article regarding guidelines for antibiotic use. I would indicate that a large number of hospitals, and I really don't know the percentage, don't have rapid PCRs available on a 24/7 basis and may not even have them really available anytime during the given day. And since the late 90s, we at Bay State Medical Center have been using mupirocin regularly for prophylaxis in essentially 100% of our cardiac surgical population. And in that given period of time, considering the rapidity with which the mupirocin is administered and the short duration of its administration, we haven't seen any evidence of resistance to the drug being used. So inherently, I think that in the absence of a rapid PCR, I think mupirocin routine use is a very good move. The other comment I would make relative to the STS guidelines is that in Bay State, and we may be singularly unusual, but if we use vancomycin, which is not commonly used, obviously, but if we do administer it, we routinely utilize an aminoglycoside, usually gentamicin, in association with it. And you indicated to administer the aminoglycoside for one dose post-op. Well, we have been DCing our antibiotics routinely at 24 hours, not the 48, because we really haven't
found
it to be an essential.
Congratulations.
And we administer the aminoglycoside for the full duration of the 24 hours. In the article you quoted on your slide, which was our article, it really doesn't indicate that the aminoglycoside should be DC'd after a single post-op dose. So I'm not sure that there is evidence to indicate anywhere in the literature that the limitations for the aminoglycoside should be only a single post-op use. The only other comment I would ask of Kathleen is in regard to the report, and this may come out tomorrow in the conference call as well, but in the reporting of the incisional infections, are we going to be reporting the primary and secondary incisional infections, assuming they're deep or superficial? Are we reporting them differently? And that's basically my question and comments.
It's a reasonable question, and the answer is I don't know. Dr. Marigakis is going to talk that over with the IPs tomorrow and find out what it is that their view is on the subject. And if everybody is collecting the data that way, then it would be nice to have it that way. If they aren't, then it would be ridiculous for us to ask for it. So we haven't set up the page in the database for this yet. That's open for discussion tomorrow.
Okay. And thanks for your comment. One is congratulations that you discontinue your antibiotics at the 24-hour mark. We had, with Lisa and Sarah Cosgrove of our IPs, done that at Hawkins as well, where we stopped everything at 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
The aminoglycosides, I think that I'll go back and look, that I would say that I felt I lifted that from the article, but I certainly, you are the expert.
Yeah, I just reread the article to look at it. But basically, I couldn't see where there was a time frame for the administration of the aminoglycoside perioperatively.
I think the other, you know, the pushing that 24-hour mark, you know, many of you know that there are there are little data supporting even 24-hour mark of antibiotics for many surgical procedures, so that because that risk period is less, that the highest risk is really concentrating on the time in the operating room. And that gentamicin would be interesting to hear what other folks feel, because I know that many cardiac surgeons really worry about gentamicin in patients who are going to put on bypass and renal effects, and it'd be great to hear Baysafe experience and any, you know, data on that does not increase a patient's risk of having a perioperative renal insult.
Mm-hmm. Well, we would be very nice to look at that data.
Any other questions or comments?
The next question is from Rita Smith. Your line is open.
Hi, Rita. How are you?
Pretty good. Good afternoon. Just wanted to ask if there's anybody on the call that for open heart surgery that adds Trionam is commonly used as a pre-op antibiotic. Does anybody encounter that, or are most programs trying to go with ANSEF unless there is an allergy to that? It sounds like that was the recommendation on the with the slide presentation. Is that correct?
Yes, that would be a recommendation because it is a first-line, a first-generation cephalosporin and has broad coverage.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be one of, you know, that you're not using the Trinam, which would have would be more of that, say, for, you know, infections, that recommendation from CDC. But we can, it's hard to take a vote right now. We might, maybe at the very end, we can open up lines or go around, but that's a great question.
Okay, and then if there is any way to assess how many programs are doing the either pre-screening with the nasal, we happen to have the PCR test here at Suburban, so I would be interested in knowing how many other programs are looking for possible colonization and then using the Bactroban for surgery, you know, before surgery.
Right, we can... We can either open up the lines or maybe just send around a quick, have sites vote in, you know, do a little vote.
Okay, thank you.
At this time, there are no questions.
So perhaps we could just briefly open up the lines, and if any of the centers use Trinam or another antibiotic as their first line, if they are happy to let us know that. That would be great if we can talk about that. And then we'll go sort of a round robin with the how many folks have PCR. So the question there would be how many have PCR and do that versus how many are using nasal decolonization and don't have PCR. So if we can open the lines.
Open all lines?
Yes, please.
One moment.
Survey
lines are now open.
We did a survey, at least in the Northeast, of those institutions that are doing cardiac surgery, of those that had the rapid PCR available, and really it was probably in the range of about 50%. So not the majority of hospitals have the availability, of, at least this was a year or two ago, of rapid PCR. It is coming on board, but it's an expensive modality, so hospitals are a little loath to undertake it.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, in terms of the STS guidelines, which have been adopted by Medicare, Trionam is not an accepted routine antibiotic for use in the Medicare population.
Right.
Thank you.
Any others with experience with an alternate antibiotic and maybe how to address that, or use of PCR and mupirocin?
This is Bethesda North in Cincinnati, and we do utilize the PCR assay.
And so when do you screen patients?
We screen them when they come in for pre-admission testing if we get them ahead of time, and then we decolonize. If not, we have the rapid PCR that we can test them right there in the hospital.
Okay. Thanks.
And when you consider the variability of the number of services that would be that would value that type of an approach, like orthopedics and the various and sundry replacements that are being done, it would really be a very valuable approach. It is very valuable.
In our healthcare organization in TriHealth, which Bethesda belongs to, we do use it for orthopedics, and we are going to be expanding it to all surgeries that have implants.
Yeah, and that's very, I think that's very valuable.
Yeah, this is Philip Gralick, UT Southwestern. We have rapid PCR. We actually use an alternative antibiotics in ceftriaxone for reasons that I probably will discover here shortly. The question I had was, we are just beginning our use of mupirocin, and I guess as we attempt to look at the practical applications of using this, I wonder if Dr. Engelman could comment on, you know, where you should put the bulk of your effort with regards to extending, you know, either preoperatively or postoperatively for more than a day or two. Where does the data seem to point us as where we should concentrate our efforts?
Clearly, preoperatively is where we're interested in having it used, and we do not routinely continue it perioperatively. But it is a preoperative, very valuable modality in our view, at any case.
And being that maximum benefit is achieved or approaches maximum after, what, day, 2 days?
I would think within 36 to 48 hours,
mm-hmm.
Correct. And it's very hard to know exactly what time frame, but obviously more than 12 hours would be beneficial, but clearly it is effective as a local sterilizing agent. Especially against staff.
So we're getting close to the top of the hour, so I just want to be respectful of everybody's time. If there's anybody else with a question.
Lisa, are you still on the call? Lisa Maragakis.
The rapid PCR, do we have that?
I think she's doesn't not sound like it anymore.
Okay. Go ahead, sorry. We're hearing just some chatting. So I think we'll go ahead and end this here. Thank you again so much, everybody. It was a great discussion at the end. We look forward to more of those. And the call with Dr. Maragakis tomorrow. Was there somebody else commenting right there?
Most everybody comes through same day.
They may be hearing us soon.
Okay. Lines are still open, so I think it's time to sign off. Lots of it's great to hear that there's discussion going on with the individual team, so that's a positive thing. Kathleen, anything else that you want to pass along, or Vicki, any other comments or updates for the team?
I'm just looking forward to being on the call with the IPs tomorrow at 2.
Great. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.